Major generally added Reel 3. General, you mentioned that you're doing gunnery and gunnery tactics. Do you remember exactly what sort of tactical exercises they were teaching you?
Usually in teaching you in support of other arms, although in many cases we had to do it without the other arms available. One had a picture given one of infantry carrying out an operation of some sort and the armoured cars supporting them, or moving in a column and having to deal with an ambush and those sort of things. We used to practice these things and perhaps do it two or three times in the day, have criticism from ourselves. We were asked to criticise our own handling of the thing, what we thought other chaps had done and so on. It was all rather well run, that sort of thing. Mark you that the tactics that an armoured car can in fact perform are pretty elementary. And particularly as we were so limited by the amount of cross-country we had.
What about the idea of mobility?
You were taught a little of that. Because we were dealing very much with the car crew, how to fire the guns, what would happen with two cars together, how they would support each other, that sort of thing. And the bigger picture of what a corps movement would do and so on was never really mentioned at all. We were dealing with very elementary tactics to section level. What is now called a troop, in those days we called them sections, five cars.
How would a car help another one?
One would take up a position, a fire position, and let the other one go forward a bit. Then he'd take up a fire position, so the next one would cover. Always looking out for the enemy and picking out a place where the enemy liked it to be or where they knew they were, where they would see the flashes of their machine guns or rifles, or whatever it is, and cover them with fire. We didn't have any smoke. We only had machine guns. The smoke discharger, which was fitted on tanks today, came on much later than that. It was all very elementary.
So to do that course, in fact, helped your career?
You had to do it. But where it helped you was if you did well on it. And I was fairly lucky in that I got a D on both those courses, a distinguished school. And that, I think, helped one in the future a bit, maybe. But you could get a Q1 or a Q2 or even a Q3, which was a sort of pass just.
Did you meet Hobart when you were out in India?
Hobart.
Hobart.
Yes. Oh, yes. We were organised in groups. And our commanding officers of the groups were lieutenant colonels. There were two groups. One was in Rawalpindi in the north of India, and one was in Pune in the south of India. And in fact, our company in Quetta came under the southern one, funnily enough. And Hobart was at that time the commanding officer of that group. And he came up to stay with us. This is the first time I'd ever met him. A very frightening figure. And he fairly shook our company. Went around, saw everything, looked at every nut and bolt, and everything to do with the company. And I got on fairly well with him because I was keen on riding, and so was he. He was a very good horseman. And I mounted him, and we went out riding in the morning, that sort of thing. I was always, in those days, very impressed with him. I thought he was far and away the best senior officer I'd met, who really knew about tanking and knew what was expected of us and could pick out straight away what was wrong and what was right and so on. We happened to have a very good commanding officer too at the time, Major Dean, who was a Dorset regiment chap in the war. And he got on very well with Herbo and they were a great success. But Herbo only came for a short time, and then we never saw him again for another year or something. I mean, to get from Pune to Quetta in those days was either, I think, 5 days in the train, or 6 days in the train, something like that, or, as I said before, ship voyage. From Karachi to Bombay, 2 days and 2 nights, and ship. It was quite a trip. There were no aeroplanes.
What do you think he was... What was his opinion, do you think, of what was going on?
I think he thought we were doing the best we could under the conditions we were operating. He wasn't keen on this Indian business, I don't think, really. He was hoping to get himself back into the movement in England, you see, which, of course, he did. But he was there for, I think, about a year. I'm not sure. I can't remember exactly.
When he visited you, did he speak about tanks?
I don't remember, honestly. I know he did. He talked to the officer several times about policy and that sort of thing. I can't really remember very much. I was a very timid second lieutenant sitting on a seat right at the back. You know, I wasn't sort of involved too much. The only contact I say I had with him is that he and I used to go out riding together. He was a good horseman.
When you returned to England, did you notice any change in the tank corps?
Remarkably little, really. The only thing that had happened was we'd begun to get some light tanks. And I went to the 3rd Battalion when I went back, which was stationed at Lydd in Kent, which was about as bad a place for tank battalion to be as anything, because all the training had to be done on shingle on the Dungeness Point. It was a nice station, a lovely place to be, wonderful sea bathing, wildfowl shooting in the winter and all that sort of thing, excellent hunting nearby. And the troops had marvellous games and things there, you see them. And they could all wish off to Folkestone when they wanted to and so on. But as a tank battalion station, it was very poor. As far as the training was concerned, we were a different attitude. Our battalion, this battalion, was a different battalion to the 2nd Battalion. We had a light company, as far as I remember, and 2 medium companies. I think I'm right in saying this. I'm a bit hazy about it. But I certainly had a light section for a bit. And our training was very inadequate, up and down this sand and shingle. But, of course, we used to move to the plain. And I think the year I came home from India, which was 1935, we went to the plain quite soon after I got there. Perhaps in May or June, I wouldn't know exactly. And we were on the plain for most of the summer, taking part in the tank brigade training. And that was quite a different thing. We were right on the ball. Hobo used to drive us round like madmen, and we were continually out on exercises, and we were expected to be able to read maps at high speed, and we moved enormous areas, covered the whole plain from Marlborough down to Salisbury, in all directions. And I think we got as far as one could possibly do, considering that the main tank was still the old Vickers tank. It was really remarkable how efficient we all were. We had this battalion had Mark II's, slightly improved tank, not much different really, but slightly better mechanically and slightly different armour arrangement and things like that. It was basically the same tank. But we were awfully good, although I shoot a line about it, we really were. I mean, compared to the rest of the army in those days, we were very good indeed. The wireless was very elementary. Very poor little wireless sets, and we had very few of them. But all that sort of thing, the communications and the administration, the bringing up of the echelons, the providing with food and petrol, and that sort of thing, was excellent. It was all very well run. And this was almost entirely Hobo. He was a wonderful leader and a tremendous trainer. And a hard man, if you got across him, you didn't last long. But I didn't stay there very long because in, was it October or November? November, I think, 1935, I was selected to go to Egypt as the staff captain of the mobile force, which was to be commanded by a Colonel V.V. Pope in my regiment, who was in India at the time. I think I'm right in saying he was commanding one of those groups that I mentioned. And I was sent out to be his staff officer. And we were forming a force to cover Egypt in the event of an Italian move in what was called the Abyssinian Crisis in 1935.
Before we come on to that, if I can come back to a couple of questions about the exercises that you just mentioned. You first of all referred to the difference between in training between the 2nd and the 3rd. What would you say they were?
I think that as far as the 3rd was concerned, I don't think that the mechanical standard, the standard of mechanical training was as high as it was in the second when I was there. But the tactical training was probably better. We had, funnily enough, the colonel happened to be the same man, Colonel Dean, who'd been the colonel of the 10th Armoured Car Company when I was there. And he was a very good tactician. And I think once we got on the plane and away from the shingle, he instilled quick movement and quick carrying out of orders and very good giving out of orders and that sort of thing, which in my day in the second battalion was not very high class. But of course, mark you, the second battalion also came into the tank brigade, and perhaps they'd changed. They changed their colonel and the whole thing was changed. I wouldn't know. But I didn't think that the standard of maintenance, cleanliness of the tanks, all that sort of thing, was as good in the third as it had been in the second when I was there. This is purely just what one felt. I was still a second tanker, although I was in the third, you see. One rather suffered from that occasionally. You wished you were back in your own old battalion, you know.
What about standard of crews? Was it the same?
Oh, yes. We always had first-class men in the Royal Tank Corps, because we had an education standard higher than other people. So we got a pick. And our men were very good. Very good chaps. And a large number of them later were the reason why the Royal Armoured Corps was such a success in the last World War, because the reservists, Royal Tank Corps reservists, were called up in all directions and sent to the mechanised cavalry and became their instructors and their NCOs and things. Yes, I always look back on the standard of the man in the Royal Tank Corps being, in those days, of being the best men I ever saw.
You mentioned the tactics of Colonel Dean.
Mm.
What other emphasis did he lay, apart from quick orders?
Well, I think he had more the feel of what later became armoured war. Although, of course, we didn't know much about it in those days, you see. It hadn't been thought out. But he certainly gave us orders which gave us training which led to adequate and well-handled squadrons and companies, as they were called then. And I don't know, somehow it's hard to explain, but I just felt that the general battle-fighting feeling in the battalion was very good. He was a very good soldier.
When you went down to those exercises, what was your main objective? What were you aiming for?
Well, we were all sent to Till's Head or somewhere like this on the plane, and you started with battalion training, company and battalion training. And when, after that had been on for a bit, when Hobo was sweeping round all the time in his car, coming to see what you were doing, after a bit, then they started exercises, brigade exercises. And the object of the exercise was, in fact, what Hobo and Little Hart and all these people were trying to teach, which was that armour could be used away from the other arms in a striking row on flanks or out in front, and that they didn't necessarily have to fight all the time tied to the infantry. And this is, after all, what eventually happened in the 1940 in the great move of the Germans through the Ardennes and Guderian run to the coast. And I think Hobo and Little Hart had a lot in common. And this was what the elements we were starting, that sort of thing. They tried it before, you see, was it called the Mechanized Brigade or something in 1928, 29 sort of time. But they never got very far with it, and there was a lot of opposition. Senior officers didn't like it, and there wasn't enough horses in it, that sort of thing. But this tank brigade was a jolly fine organization, and if it had had first-class equipment and so on, it would have been a very fine fighting organization. Because our equipment really wasn't up to fighting.
Would you say that was the principal problem with the idea?
The idea was there. Yeah. The idea was there. There's no doubt that Hobo had the idea of moving armoured forces on a wide front at high speed with the objectives of going deep into enemy territory. This is what he made us do. Not quite so much possibly in 1935 as later again when I came back in 36 after the Abyssinian thing. And then, of course, he was moved off and I think he was made director of military training or something. But certainly he had that brigade moving marvellously. And what is so sad is that the British Army lost all that when it came to the 1939-40 war. We hadn't got a proper organisation. Our armoured division wasn't trained up like this one was, and it never really functioned in the first part of the war. It wasn't until Desert Days that we used armoured divisions. And, of course, Hobo was sent out, if you remember, in 1938 or something, so, to command the armoured division, or mobile division, I think it was called then, in Egypt, and got the nucleus of the 7th Armoured Division going, and then he fell out with the commander in Egypt and was sent home on quite personal matters, which was very sad.
Were you aware at the time of this aim, this mobile aim?
Oh yes, we were aware very much of what we were trying to do. Hobo made it very clear to us all, and we had conferences and instructions and writings, and we were continually being pushed on and told to get on it and get on fast. Everything had to be fast. And you had to know where you were going, what you were doing, and you had to map read it. You were only allowed to use a quarter-inch map. And, oh, we really were kept at it.
And he personally came and...
But he was always there the whole time. We suddenly found yourself. I always remember my famous occasion when my company commander got himself into a cul-de-sac by bad map reading. We were just turning round when suddenly Hobo appeared. And... that particular company commander wasn't company commander much longer. Oh, he was very, very hot on everyone knowing that stuff. And he was always asking questions. He used to drive up alongside and signal you off your tank, second lieutenant, you see. Say, where are you now? Yes. What are you doing? Why are you doing it? He was tremendous. Tremendous chap.
Was he popular with you?
Well, I think popular as far as, yes, I think we all thought he, you know, we didn't really know him very well as a man, you know. He was just a figure, but we all thought he was tremendous. Whether he was popular with senior officers or not, I'm not so sure. I don't know, really. Some of them, yes, those that were good. Some of them, no, those that were bad. But he wouldn't stand any nonsense.
You'd say that he infused you with his idea
of
mobility.
Absolutely. I mean, he made the Royal Tank Corps, the Tank Brigade, anyway, into an extremely efficient organisation, despite the fact that it had very inefficient vehicles and fighting equipment.
You were in a light tank section, were you?
I think I'm right in saying that I was second in command of a light tank section. Can't remember quite. We had Mark 1 and 2 light tanks. Very elementary little things, one machine gun.
Do you remember what your main job was to do?
Oh, we were the reconnaissance, to go ahead and find the way and find the enemy and so on for the medium tanks behind us. Then he formed a light battalion. The 1st battalion became a light battalion, all light tanks. And the light companies were taken away from the medium battalions. They were then left with 3 medium companies. And the light battalion was a complete battalion for operating ahead of the brigade. The first battalion became the light battalion.
Were you aware at the time of this sort of doctrinal debate going on? You mentioned it a lot.
No, I don't think so.
You weren't at the time aware?
Not at my level. I was then a subaltern. And I don't think any question of the arguments that were going on at the top, Little Heart and all the rest of it, none of that impinged on us at all. I don't think, anyway.
You mentioned wireless. Yes. You had a wireless, did you, in your section?
Do you know, I think we had... we certainly didn't have wireless in every tank. I think the section commander and the subsection commanders had wirelesses. And they were very, very short range. Speech. But they weren't awfully good. They were always going wrong. Then we had a rather larger set in the medium tanks, which was rather more reliable. The numbers and things, I'm afraid I don't remember. One was called a number one set. I don't remember that. Must have been the first.
If you didn't have a tank, how would you communicate?
Well, you did it by flags. The whole of the control within the company and the troop or section was done by flags. Or by arm signals. You had a flag code and a rack of flags on your tank. And you put up a blue flag and it meant do something or other, and a red one meant something else and so on. So you didn't use wireless for control like later on we did. I mean, when I was in the desert commanding a battalion in the desert in the war, I could command my entire battalion, every tank on the same net. I could speak to everybody. But that wasn't capable, and you couldn't do that in the time I'm talking about.
When you went off on your reconnaissance on these exercises, how did you sort of keep in touch with the main brigade headquarters?
Well, as far as the light tanks were concerned, I think there again you relied on the section officer doing it. And it was all a bit hit and miss. I mean, everybody ought to have had a wireless set, and they didn't have one.
Would you then say that the exercises were a success that year?
I would have thought they were, yes. I find it difficult to divide in my mind what I knew then and what I now know.
Yes.
But I think that we thought we'd done rather well. When we came back to Lydd from the plane, I remember the colonel having an officers' conference and saying he was very pleased with the town and we'd done really well and so on. But I think we'd done as well as we could be expected to do, as I said before, with the equipment we had. We certainly learnt an awful lot, which I hope was passed on to the future chaps.
What would you say were the principal things you would learn then?
Well, I think we'd learnt the importance of communications, which had been not very good. I think we learnt the importance of rapidity in every respect in armour, with the rapid orders, clear and rapid orders, with the rapid carrying out of the orders, with good map reading, with rapid movement from place to place, no wasting of time, and with a very good administrative backing, so that you were always able to move because you were never short of petrol, that sort of thing.
You mentioned just then communications had been bad. Mm. How do you think they'd been improved by
those
exercises?
Well, they will. I didn't think they had. No, I think what I meant was that the communications had been bad on the exercises because we had so few wireless sets. And such, in fact, such rather poor wireless sets. And communications had been marvellous considering what we went through. You know, how our sets were very inadequate. Short range and, in fact, impossible to use at night.
Did you do any night work?
Yes, we moved by night, yes. But wireless communications at night in those days, was, as it was later on in the Great War, in the war, the Second War, well, very, very difficult indeed. Very difficult.
What about the press accounts? Did you ever read any press accounts?
We used to read, yes. Very often there were press accounts in the Times and the Telegraph, and we used to read them avidly to see whether we were mentioned and whether we'd done well. I always thought that the correspondent of the Times at that time, I don't know whether Little Hart was at that particular time, but whoever it was, wrote awfully good reports on the tank brigade training and other training in the army, and one always read them with great interest. These chaps got a very good view of what was going on and wrote it very well. There was no secrecy or anything like that at all, as far as I could make it. I think it was Little Hart was at that time. I think he was the correspondent at the time.
And this, in fact, you found gave you some sort of moral support, didn't
it? Oh, yes, we all used to read the papers, see how we got on. Yes.
One final question about them. Did you do any gunnery work on them, on those exercises?
No, we didn't fire. Not live, no. Okay. One always had one. Oh, yes, one always gave one's orders, and guns were pointed in the right direction and all this sort of thing. But we didn't do any firing. In some cases, we had blank, but nobody liked firing blank because it made a frightful mess of your guns. They were awfully hard to clean after, so the soldiers used to avoid firing the blanks if they possibly could. So we also had blank firing attachments on the machine guns, which used to make a noise.
So in other words, you'd avoid firing altogether then?
If you possibly could, yes.
So gunnery would be something that, in fact, was a weakness, was it?
Well, no, I don't think so, because I think if we had to fire, we'd have fired all right. We had plenty of training. We all went and did our practice camp firing and so on, you know. But in the actual exercises, you had your gunner in position. You were meant to give, and did, if you were efficient, give fire orders, which they were supposed to carry out, put on the range, all that sort of thing. But of course, we didn't actually fire. Couldn't very well fire each other on top of the plane.
Why were you chosen to go out to Egypt, do you think?
Well, that's a hard question. If you read Armored Warfare, you'll see that Hobo says, he writes to V.V. Pope and says, I'm sending you one of our best subalterns, probably Ardage.
This came as a big surprise to you, didn't it?
I didn't know I was going there. I didn't have any idea at all. I'd never hit it off with Hobo in the past. Perhaps in India. I don't know. He was a chap who took likes and dislikes. And I was one of his blue-eyed boys, I think, really. That's how it came about. I was very pleased to do the job. It was a very interesting job. Excellent job.
What were your duties out there?
Well, I went out there originally, you see, to be staff officer to Pope, who was going to command the tank side of the arm of the mobile force. And he came from India, and I met him off the Strathnava in the canal. We went and stayed a night with General Tim Pyle, who died, as you saw, 3 days ago. He was in commanding the Canal Brigade and was an ex-Royal Tank Corps officer and a great friend of V.V. Pope's. And we had great discussions about how the armour should be handled and what we should do. I was most interested to hear all this because I sat at the back and listened. I was amazed what a tremendous grasp of what I thought was high-class armoured warfare these two chaps had, and in particular V.V. Pope, that he was a very far-seeing, you know, very good tactician and very filled, imbued with the armoured warfare outlook. His death in the war was a great loss.
What would you say was the main emphasis? What were they saying, in fact?
Well, what we were after, really, was how we, with a force of mostly light tanks, could deal with the Italians if they had come, because they had a fair number of rather better medium tanks than we had. They also had a lot of very poor light tanks, which weren't as good.